This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. As Hurricane Michael battered the panhandle Wednesday, candidates running for election in the midterms suspended their campaigns and rolled into disaster response mode. But even as the eye of the storm came ashore, some attack ads were still flying, prompting cries of foul play. A major hurricane or any disaster is a test of leadership, but what impact does a catastrophic storm have on a political campaign? Do you like what you see in the leadership on display this week from the state, federal and local level? And what about the impact of the storm on voter registration? What might be the political legacy of Hurricane Michael? We're taking your calls at 1-866-338-5252 and your comments and questions on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. Joining us from Gainesville, Tramell Gomes, host of the Rotunda podcast. Tramell, welcome back to Intersection.
Thanks for having me.
We're also joined by Osceola County Supervisor of Elections, Mary Jane Arrington. Mary Jane, welcome back to Intersection as well.
Thank you.
And with us in the studio, Aubrey Jewett, political science professor at the University of Central Florida. Welcome back to you too.
Nice to be here.
You can join the conversation as well. What do you make of the response from local and state leaders? And what kind of impact do you see this hurricane having on the midterm elections in Florida? Is it going to influence how you vote in November? And what about the impact of the storm on voter registration? You can call us. We're at 1-866-338-5252. Send us a tweet, questions and comments on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. Tramell, I want to start with you. You're in Gainesville at the moment, but you are planning to head back to Tallahassee. Check out your house. How are things looking there from what you know so far?
Well, as for the rest of the city, it's the second day of power restoration, and still what I'm reading is 76% are still in the dark, and that could possibly include my house. I saw from pictures, I was fortunate to have friends drive by my home, and the only thing that's there is a big limb leaning on my roof. So I'm happy about that. Nothing's bore through, so it's good. But for the rest of the city, it's still power restoration mode. From what I'm seeing, like immediately stuff, those who went out of power, the restoration process started very early in the morning in getting people back up. But for those who are still in the dark, I know it's tense, and with our weather, the humidity, it's going to be uncomfortable. So we're still waiting to see and hoping for 100% recovery soon.
Right, because, of course, having seen some of the pictures, heard some of the reports from where the hurricane came ashore in the panhandle, the Pensacola area, in Panama City and places like that, those images are just unimaginable, like trees snapped in half, houses completely wiped off their foundations. And then the storm, of course, still a very powerful storm as it moved inland. So power seems to be the big issue in Tallahassee a little bit further inland, right?
Yes, and to give some perspective, and our hearts go out to Mexico Beach and Panama City that took the real brunt of this, and homes flattened and everything. But Tallahassee, it's Tree City. We can't even handle too much rain because these trees topple over. That happened to my house a month ago, actually. Mm-hmm. So just heavy winds coupled with the rain, it's still a major threat to the city. And we had some of the similar issues with trees snapping, and there are pictures all around Tallahassee with trees falling in people's homes. But nothing compared to what we're seeing in Panama City and in that region.
I guess the city of Tallahassee specifically had a bit of a dress rehearsal a year or two back with Hurricane Hermine, right? Power restoration took a while there. And just on that note, I was looking at Twitter last night, and I noticed there was some video footage of the mayor of Tallahassee, Andrew Gillum, getting his hands dirty. He had a chainsaw in hand. He was literally himself chainsawing trees that were down on the road. So he's clearly busy and, I guess, leading from the front there. What else are you seeing as far as the way that the city and other leaders are responding to this disaster, Tramell Gomes?
Well, that's what I wonder if it's to credit, and that's probably unfair to credit during this election time, so close to the general election, but it was all hands on deck. From these elected officials, from the Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum to Governor Rick Scott, They looked in charge. They were on the scene, as you mentioned. Mayor Andrew Gillum with the chainsaw. Reporters were tweeting that he was out there with his chief of staff for 45 minutes, like trying to cut down the trees. Those are really good images showing that they're on top of what's going on. And then also seeing the updates, they were very busy, particularly the mayor on social media, Facebook Live, giving updates over and over again as to what's happening. And they were trying to make sure that the dust up and all the chaos of the storm of Hermine a couple of years ago is not repeated, even though some of the attacks back then, I was in Tallahassee throughout the storm. Mm-hmm. You could see some were politically motivated, even as the city was trying to get up to speed and get back.
We're talking about the impact, the confluence of hurricanes and a political election season. We are in the final weeks before the midterm elections, and things pretty tight in that gubernatorial race. I want to hear from you as well. What are you seeing, what are you hearing, and what are your thoughts leading into this election? What kind of impact do you think the storm and its aftermath may have? What is the political legacy there? 1-866-338-5252 is the number. You can also send us a tweet, comments and questions at WMFE Orlando on Twitter. I want to play a little bit of tape. Here's an interview we did with Chris King yesterday. He is Andrew Gillum's running mate. He's echoing Gillum's criticism of his Republican rival Ron DeSantis after the Republican Party of Florida kept ads attacking Gillum on the air during the storm. Let's take a listen.
During the storm, really for one of the first times that we can remember in Florida's political history, Ron DeSantis kept his ads, particularly his negative ads, running in the strike zone. Governor Bush, Governor Crist, Governor Graham all came out and said, this is not what Floridians do. We come together. And Ron DeSantis was on Fox News last night going after Mayor Gillum while the storm was playing out in North Florida. So we're committed to doing everything in our power to help the people of North Florida.
Should note, too, that attack ads in support of Senator Bill Nelson and also his Republican rival in the Senate race, Governor Rick Scott, were also running. But as Politico's Mark Caputo noted in an article, the difference between the Senate campaign and the gubernatorial campaign is that the Senate campaigns have no say in those political ads. Aubrey Jewett, political science professor with UCF, want to bring you into this conversation. I mean, it's been noted that it's kind of taboo-breaking to keep these ads on air during a storm. Just give us a sense, give us some context. Has this happened before in your memory?
No, it hasn't. It has been an unwritten norm or rule in Florida politics that if we have a natural disaster like a hurricane and it's in campaign season, that typically campaigns are officially suspended and that ads, and particularly negative ads, would not run where the hurricane was having, you know, most of its impact.
Mm-hmm.
Now, having said that, you know, there's no law against it. It's not illegal or anything like that. And so to the degree that this norm is going to be enforced, it's going to be up to voters to say, hey, we either like this or we don't approve of it. And it's certainly unusual to be running ads like that across North Florida.
Mm-hmm. Where does this unwritten rule come from? What's the genesis of it?
Well, I think it's the thought that despite how nasty political campaigns often get, when you're dealing with a natural disaster, then people are supposed to pull together, at least temporarily, and even if it's a little bit fake, but they're supposed to come together and say, no, all of our attention is going to be on the hurricane, the response, especially helping the victims, and that negative political advertising in particular in those areas is just inappropriate at that time.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about the impact of Hurricane Michael on the political election season. You can reach out on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. I want to talk, too, about another impact of the storm, and that is on voter registration. The deadline was earlier in the week, but there were some calls also from the Democratic Party of Florida, particularly to extend that deadline across the board for the entire state. A judge ruled that that was not going to happen, but some grumbling from some folks about making sure that people were able to register in the midst of this disaster. And I want to bring in Mary Jane Arrington, the Osceola County Supervisor of Election. Just give us a sense of, is this something that you would expect to see during a major storm? And for some context,
In 2016, mm-hmm. the deadline for voter registration was extended by a week because of a storm.
Mm-hmm.
And the deadline in the 30 possibly affected counties in the Panhandle Big Bend area is extended to the day that they reopen their office.
Mm-hmm.
And today I have already heard from Supervisor Lux in Bay County, and he is opening today. Maybe limping, but they are opening today as Leon County and most of the counties in the affected area. We all have a plan, an emergency operation plan that you know, we are ready to get up and running as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
During the storm season, especially because that coincides with our election season.
As far as opening, though, you know, the day that they can get back up and running, is that it, though? Is that the day to register, or is there a bit of leeway? Because if people are still trying to rebuild, they might need a bit more time. I mean, registering to vote may be the last thing on their minds.
Well, I agree, and we are a society of procrastinators. We wait to the last day to do whatever we need to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so the directive that we received from the Secretary of State is that you have to have your application in today by the close of business.
Mm-hmm. What can supervisors of elections do to help people get that done? I mean, is there anything other than just kind of extending the deadline a little bit and opening when they can to kind of help people get to the supervisor of elections office, or is there a way to do it online? Like, what other things can you do?
You can register online, but I believe that the Secretary's directive did not include extending online registration, just turning in physical applications at the supervisor's office.
Mm-hmm. Aside from outside groups calling for an extension, you know, be it the Democratic Party of Florida or other groups, do supervisors of elections themselves have some sort of say in saying, look, we don't think it's reasonable to, you know, to have this deadline fall on the day it does. We need a little more time. Like, do you kind of get together and advocate for an extension if there's the need for it?
We have not. I don't, you know, it is set in law when book closing occurs, and the governor is the only person who can extend that.
Mm-hmm. And speaking about the fact that you have to make sure you've got a plan in place for hurricane season, it's pretty important, of course. Are voter registration offices, are they kind of hardened like EOCs? Do they have a little more sort of resilience as far as making sure they're storm ready?
Right. Yes. I mean, our building, we are built a little bit better than the average building, but we have county buildings that are available to us,
mm-hmm,
that can withstand the storm, that we can move our equipment in Osceola County. And if this had been us, that's what we would have been doing, would be moving our equipment into our, you know, our polls, the equipment that goes to the polling locations,
mm-hmm,
and early voting sites. We would be moving it into those safe buildings. The biggest obstacle I see right now, especially for Supervisor Lux in Bay County, is the destruction of polling locations.
Mm-hmm.
Because once they're gone, I mean, voters don't know where to go vote then.
Right.
And communication is limited, and it is a real problem if there's no longer a building there for me to go hold early voting or have as a polling location. I have a problem.
Right. So what would you do in that situation? Would you set up a tent or some kind of portable
site? A tent or a mobile unit with, you know, our workers are trained to process voters the old-fashioned way on paper,
mm-hmm,
if we need to. And we that is what our plan calls for, is mobile units like the FEMA trailers or setting up tents.
Do you in Osceola County have some of those mobile units, or is that the state's responsibility to provide those?
We have agreements with state and other vendors that if we need these, we can get these.
Mm-hmm.
So I do know in Charlotte County, when Charlie came through in 2004, they set up tents
for
voters.
Oh, and just back to Bay County, what you mentioned before, what else are you hearing from the supervisor election? Like, how is their office doing? And I guess the other issue might well be getting there, like roads and stuff. There's, mm-hmm, so much devastation, trees down.
And that is what he said. They're going to be open. Their building did not suffer any major damage.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have internet right now. So we got a text message.
Right.
And so thank goodness for modern technology, right?
Right.
And that they will be up and running, because this is a very busy time of the year for us.
Sure.
The busiest time, you know, right before a general election is extremely busy in our offices.
Mm-hmm. And then what about sort of staffing up? Because I imagine a lot of those staff, some of them, they might be having to deal with devastation in their own
right.
homes.
Or they may not be there.
Right.
They may have evacuated. So, I mean, you know, what we try to do is work as an organization. And I do know that in the past, other staff have from other counties have gone to help if they need to.
Mm-hmm.
Not that we all don't need all the staff that we have.
Right. Tramell Gomes, I want to just bring you back into this conversation. What about up in your neck of the woods in Tallahassee? What are you hearing as far as the registration to vote there? Any sort of word on whether they had to sort of push things back and when they might reopen?
I have not gotten any specific word or seen any specific movements on that just yet. I'll be tuning in to see where things are. But just as we're talking to you, I see from the Gillum campaign, like, you know, politics is back.
Mm-hmm.
An ad highlighting a Tampa Bay Times article regarding the Ron DeSantis over healthcare and his position on that 3 weeks and how he's been silent. So you can kind of feel that things are sort of with the campaigns getting back to normal.
Mm-hmm.
But to the question of the attack ads from Audrey Jewett, one of the things that was different compared to the other attack ads, compared to Senator Bill Nelson and others in the gubernatorial race, Ron DeSantis's his attack ad was particularly about hurricane response from Hermine. So it
right.
was different. It wasn't just a normal attack ad like the others that they were taking down. This one was about a storm a couple of years ago, and it had facts wrong and all of that stuff. But while I was in South Florida and having lunch and seeing this ad run as we're waiting for Michael to make landfall, I was like, wow, this is really pushing it out there.
And that must be a little bit kind of blurring the lines a bit if you're seeing an attack ad which has footage from a previous storm showing a mayor or some other elected official in their official capacity. It's probably going to be black and white, as these attack ads normally are, or some kind of dull coloration. But if you see that and then you're contrasting that with the live footage of that same elected official kind of trying to get an emergency message out, that is sort of blurring the lines a wee bit, right?
Yeah, it is blurring the lines. And whoever is seeing that messaging, and the good thing about storms or storm coverage, it's 24 hours, and everyone, we're all glued to the TV. So the free media that these candidates receive during their active duty and being present on top of things, you would hope that drowns out the messaging of campaign ads, which campaign ads are not necessarily factual mm-hmm. at all outside of these that are in question. So, yeah, it just blurs the lines. But in the end, we're all watching for that day-to-day, minute-to-minute update of the actual storm. And when these candidates are being interviewed by these media outlets, we're listening to their words and hopefully not too much about the commercials between those breaks.
Right, but I do note that in some of those press conferences, there were some questions lobbed from the journalists about these attack ads specifically and some of the sort of politics of the race. It wasn't all just about storm response and recovery and preparation.
Yeah, and it's you can watch to see how they respond to it. Some of them try to pivot the best way they can, and with these glossy terms like, oh, it's not a time for partisanship, and we look ahead and all of that stuff. So during this storm, and Audrey Drew can attest to it, like it showed what the candidates can do, and it helped those who are actually in positions, like the governor, Mayor Andrew Gillum, but those opponents like Ron DeSantis, they didn't have that bully pulpit. So mm-hmm. it was, they're not getting that spotlight. So they're doing what they can outside of with those ads.
And let me bring you back into this conversation, Aubrey Jewett. So obviously, if you're getting airtime, whether you're talking about a storm or anything else, that essentially is you're getting your face in front of the cameras, you're getting your message out there. And if you're in a leadership position, that is, as we said before, it's kind of a test of your leadership, your ability to organize and respond there. A lot was said about the bump in polling that Governor Rick Scott got after the 2017 storm season, but he didn't invent this kind of method of responding, right? This kind of goes back some ways.
Indeed, the Floridians do judge, well, as all voters really, they do judge their elected officials on crisis response. And particularly if you're an executive official, governor or mayor, then leadership is expected during these times.
Mm-hmm.
And so this goes back, I mean, in sort of modern Florida times, you know, it goes back to Hurricane Andrew and Lawton Chiles, who was initially criticized a little bit for the slow response to Hurricane Andrew, although then it really geared up and he went on to re-election. Jeb Bush back in 2004 when we had four hurricanes hit Florida in like 40 days. I mean, it was a very short period of time. Again, his popularity went up. He was not on the ballot that year, but his brother was running for president and, you know, was on the ballot about 2 months after those storms hit. And some people think that that helped George W. a little mm-hmm. bit. You know, Jeb sort of, the positive feelings about Jeb maybe rubbed off a little bit on George W.
And before we came on air, we were just chatting about Hurricane Andrew and that storm season. You said that the campaign was actually suspended in Florida, which also might have been a boost for at least one of those candidates, right?
Right, yeah. With the presidential candidate, the presidential mm-hmm. race, they really suspended all campaigning. They stopped coming down here, and Florida was a hotly contested state, as it usually is. But both Kerry and George W. did not come down at all, you know, for a period of weeks or maybe even a month, and didn't really do active campaigning.
Mm-hmm.
And that probably did help George W. Bush a little there as well, because he was ahead in the polls by a little bit at the time. And thus, if you're ahead and campaigning stops, that's a benefit to you. And as in this election for Andrew Gillum, I think that's a little bit of a benefit. Polls show that he's ahead by a little bit, 2-3 points, has had a steady lead. And he's been in the news a fair bit more than Ron DeSantis because he's a mayor and the storm is hitting his area. And mm-hmm. and this is not, we haven't talked about the Senate race, but we did mention, of course, Governor Scott. And yeah, if you had to rank these four statewide candidates right now in terms of the free media exposure they're getting and positive media exposure, then Governor Scott would be at the top of the list. There's people that actually do this. They count like how many minutes you get and how much it's worth in advertising. And Scott's clearly number one in terms of free positive advertising. Gillum trailing in second. Sort of somewhat distant third would be Bill Nelson, who has a little bit of a role as a U.S. senator, but trailing badly, many lengths behind would be DeSantis, who has no official role. He resigned his position in Congress, so he really has no official role in the response to this hurricane.
Mm-hmm. If he hadn't resigned his role, though, would he have any kind of role to play?
Probably be equaling U.S. Senator Bill Nelson. You know, he'd be a distant third, but he'd probably get at least a little more exposure because mm-hmm. he'd have some official role and say, you know, we're going to make sure we get FEMA money or something like that.
We talked a little bit about the kind of sometimes the jousting between the federal and the state level. I want to just come back to that real quick in the final minute here, Aubrey Jewett. Are we seeing a little bit of that already? Is there kind of consistency between the sort of message you're hearing from federal response and state response?
Well, I think we will get a fairly consistent and hopefully cohesive response to this. I do know that there was a little bit of sniping as the hurricane was about to come on shore about like between President Trump and Scott and Gillum.
Mm-hmm.
But I think largely it also depends on just the perception of the public. And so if they feel like the response, particularly those that are actually affected, if they feel like the response is positive and pretty quick, then there's unity. Federal and state get along. If there's criticism, then there's blame shifting.
Mm-hmm. Aubrey Jewett, political science professor at the University of Central Florida, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
We're also joined by the Osceola County Supervisor of Elections, Mary Jane Arrington. Thank you again, Mary Jane.
You are welcome.
And Tramell Gomes, host of the Rotunda podcast. Thanks, Tramell, and good luck. Hope your house is okay up in Tallahassee.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Up next, a conversation with Stockton Reeves. He's the GOP candidate for Florida House District 47. Stay tuned for that. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The war of words in the race for Florida House District 47 is heating up. Earlier this week, we talked to Democratic candidate Anna Escamani about the issues she's campaigning on. Today, a conversation with Republican Stockton Reeves. He's the executive director of the Center for Public Safety, which focuses on research and planning for police, fire, and other first responders building new facilities. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
What are the big issues that you want to address if you're elected to this position?
Well, I think the first would be public safety, because that's what I deal with every day. I deal with police chiefs and fire chiefs, emergency managers. And I will tell you, we're working in 16 states right now, and you've read a lot in the news over the past few years about civilians getting hurt, getting shot, officers firing 50, 60, 70 rounds during an incident, officers getting hurt. And the thing that I see is, no matter where we go, there's not every department has the size of an Orange County or an Orlando. So the first thing when budgets get cut, training gets cut. And that's the one thing that should not be cut. I'm a firm believer that the more training that these public safety entities can do and engage in and have their people brought up to speed on, the better off you are. Most of the agencies in the state meet the minimum certification. That's the minimum. It's not competency. It's just the minimum. And most of these people don't have the ability or the resources to create the training opportunities. So my thought was to work with Steve Casey at the Florida Sheriff's Association, Amy Mercer at the Florida Police Chiefs Association, bring FDLE into the equation and see if we can create what I would call like a super regional training facility.
Just to back up a little bit, when you say you're working in 16 states, you're referring to the company that you manage, the
Correct.
Architecture firm, which designs public safety facilities, police stations,
right.
fire stations.
Yeah, one is the Center for Public Safety, and they do a lot of the upfront studies, feasibility studies, cost development options. The other is Architects Design Group, which actually plans and designs the building.
Mm-hmm. How would you pay for a training facility, and how expensive would it be? Like, have you thought through that far?
We have, because we've done these around the country, and they're not inexpensive projects. And part of the reason why I wanted to go talk to the Florida Sheriff's Association, the Florida Police Chiefs, is to figure out what revenue sources or revenue streams that could be available for us to bring that together.
Mm-hmm.
It's obviously something that's probably not going to be paid for immediately. You'll probably have to save that money for a few years.
Now, when you talk about setting aside a pool of money, are you talking about a trust fund, sort of like the Sadowski Fund for housing?
Exactly.
And how would you make sure that lawmakers didn't raid that fund for other things? Because that's been the problem with the Sadowski Fund.
That has been the problem with a lot of different areas.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing I could say is you've got to fight hard, you'd have to be loud about it, and you have to make people aware about what this is and what the need is. I will give you an example. We did the Orlando Police Department's 55-line firing range. And I think at the beginning of that project, if an officer drew their weapon and shot at 21 feet, the hit rate would be 18%.
Mm-hmm.
A year after that facility was built and the officers were training, I think the hit rate went up to about 82%, and they had a huge decrease in the amount of shots that were fired. So officers were learning when it would be appropriate to use force and when would it be appropriate not to.
Do you think that's something that's lacking at the moment?
I think that's lacking in a lot of departments across the country.
Mm-hmm.
Because they simply don't have – so many people, as I said, are meeting the minimum standard, and the minimum standard is not competency. That's the important point to understand.
Not competency?
Yeah. You have a minimum standard that's here, and then you get up here, and that's competency. You want your people to be competent and fully trained.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want somebody to walk into a firing range at a stationary position, fire 20 shots, and walk out the door and get their certification. What you want them to do is to be put in certain situations where they have to react to light and noise and crowds of people and people that don't necessarily speak your language, or maybe they're hearing impaired. So you have to have training to understand how to deal with those situations as they arise.
Stockton Reeves, I want to move on to a couple of other things. I mean, affordable housing is something that has been in the headlines a lot in Central Florida because there is a crisis. We just have a lack of affordable housing. There are a lot of people who aren't making enough money. They essentially can't afford to live here. So how would you try to solve that, or at least move towards it?
Well, I did serve 6 years on the Winter Park Housing Authority, including times as chairman and vice chairman, so I got to see that need firsthand.
Mm-hmm.
We do have the second or third largest university in UCF, and all of those young people coming out, if they want to stay here, if they want to work here, affordable housing is an issue. I would think that I've talked to a couple of people about this, and I think if we work that into comprehensive plans, development plans, there should be certain set-asides that if you're going to come in and develop a 500-person division of homes, maybe certain parts of those are set aside for what you would call workforce housing, people who are in law enforcement, nurses, teachers, you know, the folks who would have an opportunity to come in and either rent or purchase, but the homes would not be priced as high.
So you'd have to work in law enforcement or teaching or something like that to qualify for renting one of those places?
There are projects that have been done like that around the state. In fact, they tried to do one down in Osceola County a few years ago. But you could do that work where, you know, 5% of the housing is set aside for what you call workforce housing or affordable housing.
Is that enough, 5%?
I don't know. We'd have to go back in and check it. But we're not talking about Section 8 housing either. So that's a different situation.
Just picking up off the idea of public safety, what about the idea of gun safety? Because, you know, Orlando's kind of been the epicenter of this debate over gun safety, and that was really brought to the forefront with the Pulse shooting. What are your thoughts about trying to tackle something statewide that might address that issue?
Again, drawing back on my experience, I will tell you that what happened down in Parkland, that individual, that assailant, had been reported to counselors, teachers, different law enforcement agencies. And the problem was, number one, nobody communicated that. Nobody shared that information. So that kind of fell through the cracks. The second thing is, you can have somebody in law enforcement who's 30 years into their career, and they are a great police officer, they're a great deputy sheriff, but they have never been trained in how to assess and evaluate people based on either a psychiatric or a psychological profile. Again, going back to talking with the Florida Sheriff's Association, the Florida Police Chiefs, I really believe that FDLE needs to bring on psychiatrists and psychologists who can do nothing but assess these threats as they come in and make these evaluations. Do these people need to be Baker-acted? Do they need to be investigated more thoroughly? Do they need to be vetted through other agencies and, you know, have things like red flag laws? If they're deemed a threat, credible threat to themselves and others, and they have firearms and ammunition, perhaps that needs to be a wave that we can avail ourselves to pull those back from those people.
Do you think you might run into some issues, though, trying to roll out some tougher restrictions then? I mean, are you going to start infringing people's Second Amendment rights?
Well, you have to understand this is not going to happen to a lot of people in the course of anything else. You have to be deemed a credible threat to yourself or others. And by that means, I think we're talking about a very small number of people. But if we're going to try to protect ourselves, these people that are psychologically or whatever cannot handle the responsibility of having either a firearm or ammunition, that may be something that needs to be looked at.
What about people who don't have mental health red flags?
And what's the question?
How would you then assess whether they're a threat or not if somebody doesn't have some psychological issues that might disqualify them from owning a firearm?
Have they ever posted anything on the internet? Have they ever written anything? Have they made any threats? Have their neighbors reported them? Did they have any issues of domestic violence or violence in and of themselves?
So, I mean, law enforcement, are they not already keeping an eye on those things?
I don't believe so.
And that comes down to what, just more resources into that area?
It does. It comes down to training, comes down to resources, and it comes down to understanding. Law enforcement has changed a lot over the past 10, 15 years. What we ask the men and women in law enforcement to do is not just stop a car and issue a ticket anymore. We're asking them to take on more and more responsibilities. And I believe it goes back to we have to be able to train them adequately. We have to equip them adequately so they can handle these additional responsibilities. And if you're having a frontline officer come up to a house and interact with somebody who they've called in that's a threat, they have to be able to think to themselves, do I need to have this person Baker-acted? Do I need to have this person reported up to somebody else that can evaluate them, that's better prepared to evaluate them? That's the process, and the process has to change.
And if you're talking about Baker-acting, that gets into the realm of mental health treatment. Are we putting enough resources into mental health assessment and evaluation and treatment in the state of Florida?
No, we're not.
And how do you change that?
Well, it's going to have to be a budgetary issue, and it's going to have to start at the county level because that's where you're dealing with people, the sheriff's office and the municipalities, and that's where I think FDLE can – you know, the bottom line is we have a lot of different agencies that don't talk to each other, that don't communicate, that don't share information. And I think if we can – if I can get to Tallahassee and work with these entities, that one of the things would be to share that information. We design emergency operations centers. We also do things called fusion centers, where you're bringing different entities under one roof so they can share things, they can talk, they can talk about the cases they're working on or things that they're following, they can talk about trends that are happening in their community. And it's the same thing. You've got to get the Winter Parks and the Orlandos and the Maitlands and the Apopkas talking to Orange County. They've got to talk to the MBI, which is the Metropolitan Bureau of Investigation. They've got to talk to FDLE. And then they've got to share that information with Osceola and Seminole and Lake County and Polk Counties.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. We're talking to Stockton Reeves. He's a Republican candidate for Florida's House District 47 in Central Florida. I mean, a lot of these things you talk about trying to make communication lines better, but then other issues, you mentioned it's a budgetary thing. Some of these things are going to be expensive. How do you pay for it?
Well, that's a very good question. And the bottom line is I can't tell you right now that we're going to pay for this by doing why. It's a matter of getting in there. We were able to go to Tallahassee after the primary's over and talk to some of the committee chairmen. It was really like a round robin. I mean, I had 10 minutes to talk to this chairperson, this policy person, this policy person. We haven't had enough time to avail ourselves to dig down into what is really an $88.2 billion budget to see what's available and what's there. And I understand that over 50% of the budget is set by the time you even get to Tallahassee with the outlays and entitlement programs and other programs. So there's very, very little bout of that budget that's really available for looking at new programs or reallocating money. But that's one of the things I would like to delve into.
What about education? Because that is an issue that is close to a lot of people's hearts. What do you think is important to focus on from an education standpoint if you're elected to the Florida House of Representatives, and how would you go about implementing that vision?
Well, in my family, we have the Reeves Family Foundation, and that provides a financial scholarship to a child at Winter Park High School who is academically qualified but financially disadvantaged, and we've been doing that. I'd like to see us, if I talk to all my parents, maybe we can do that at Boone and Oak Ridge too. My emphasis is a little different. It's more on K through 12 education. I have two children. My son is in one of the high schools in the Orange County Public School System. My daughter will be going to the ninth grade center, then to Winter Park when she comes of that part in her life. But I do think teachers are underpaid. I really do for the job they do. My sister-in-law is a teacher over in Pinellas County, and education is something that's near and dear to our hearts.
So how do you pay teachers more? It all comes back to the budget, right?
Yeah, everything in life comes back to money, doesn't it? And again, I don't have a ready answer for that per se, but I think if we can get up there and take a look at where the money comes in, where the money goes out, there's got to be a way to economize that.
High-stakes testing is something that a lot of people have some thoughts about. What's your thought on that, and what do you think needs to change there, if anything?
Well, I will tell you, I think we test too much. I went out and knocked on about 2,500 houses in the course of the primary, and I ran into about 36 different teachers. And every one of them, the very first complaint I heard was, we don't teach anymore. We have so many tests that come up through the course of the year that we end up testing or teaching our kids how to take this test. So the teaching's really been taken out of the classroom. And if you look at, I think it was Oregon or Washington State have decided that for the next year, they're not going to do any testing. Okay, they're just going to eliminate that and go back to teaching. I think we do test too much. I would like to see us cut back on some of that testing, because so much of what that school, from what I hear from the administrators, is that based on the test scores is what's going to get allocated for the budget, and that's going to drive what happens at that school. And so you're really moving away from what you should be doing, which is teaching, into testing and using those tests to make sure that everything comes up in terms of funding for those schools. Instead of just letting the teachers teach.
I want to ask about transportation, too, because mass transit is something that probably could be improved here in Central Florida. Do you have some thoughts on how that might happen?
Yes. Ironically, when I was in high school, the bill that I took to Youth Ledge was a high-speed rail bill. It didn't get very far in Youth Ledge, but I've always been a proponent of high-speed rail. I worked in Washington for 2 years, and I used the metro up there probably every day that I worked there. The problem in Central Florida is that we've never really been able to look 20, 30 years down the line. If you're in downtown Orlando and you live out in the suburbs, you're going to find out there's very few east-west arterial routes to get out there. And so if you're driving down to Loma or Colonial, the lines are backed up, the cars are slow, it's frustrating. I really think if we can get our high-speed rail here in Central Florida on the weekends, working at night, connect it to All Aboard Florida, connect it to Brightline, and then be able to do the feeder routes, get people in on buses and get people to – you know, what we're doing in terms of building housing near where these stations are, I think, is a good thing. People can live and work and walk and get to where they need to be. And a lot of, you know, transportation has changed. I mean, you know, a couple of years ago, there was no such thing as Uber or Lyft. You know, there was no ride-sharing economy out there. And so now it's easier for people than ever before to get from point A to point B, even if you don't even own a car. When I was on the Housing Authority in Winter Park, one of the things that we realized was an issue was the people that lived there couldn't get to work because they had to walk from Market Square to Lee Road or to 1792. So we tried to work with Lynx to bring a bus in there to get those people to where they could have access to transportation.
And did you succeed?
Unfortunately, I got off the board before we were doing it, but I remember those meetings with Lynx and working with our executive director and trying to push that very diligently.
Stockton Reeves, I want to ask you about the way you've campaigned too, because there has been some publicity around some of the mailers that have gone out targeting your opponent in this race, Anna Eskamani. Do you think that was a misstep on your part, labeling her as too extreme, too vulgar for Central Florida?
Matthew, that wasn't an attack on her character. That was a reflection of her character. And those words that we put on those flyers were not my words. They were not anybody else's words. Those were her words. Those words were hyperpartisan. They were extreme. They were radical. And when you get out there and chant, hey, hey, ho, ho, capitalism has got to go, and this country was built on oppression, I think people need to hear that.
Stockton Reeves, Republican and candidate for Florida's House District 47, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Matthew. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
And a note, the day we taped this interview, Anna Eskamani sent a letter to the Republican Party of Florida saying she never made the statement, hey, hey, ho, ho, capitalism has got to go. Eskamani said the advertisements are, quote, deliberately deceptive and untruthful, and she demands the Republican Party cease the use of fake quotes attributed to her. You can find our interview with Anna Eskamani at wmfe.org/intersection. Up next, new music from BMO. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Here's BMO with a track called Barricades from their new album, Busting Out.
It's unfolding all the same. By the choices that you made, blame it all on fate. At the slightest touch, you turn away. You show your back to those reaching in. Wrapped yourself in barricades. Of course the quiet is deafening. You stand alone in this crowded place with the sadness tinged mask of strength that's meant to hide. Hide away. A subtle coward afraid to face the idle hours of all those days that you're content to let drift away. At the slightest touch, you pull away. You show your back to those reaching in. Wrapped yourself in barricades. Of course the quiet is deafening. At the slightest touch, you turn away. And show your back to those reaching in. Wrapped yourself in barricades. Of course the quiet is deafening. The slightest touch, turn away. Show your back to those reaching in. Wrap yourself in barricades. I curse the quiet.
Hey!
Thank you.
Well, BMO are Dan Harshbarger, Tony Mickle, Matt Giuliano, and Justin Braun. Thank you so much for coming back.
Oh, thank you so much for having us.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks, man.
So when you perform live, do you have some more musicians on stage?
We haven't to date. Right now, what we tried to do with the album was sort of replicate the fullness of the live sound that we have. When we first went into the studio to start this album, we noticed we went in with the drum kit and everybody's instruments, but it just, for whatever reason, it sounded clean, it sounded nice, but it just didn't have the same feeling.
Oomph, punch.
Yeah, punch that we feel in a room when we play live. So what we realized with our producer, Matt Tonner, was that there were just some sonic gaps that we had, and we wanted to fill those spaces with instruments that matched our sound but didn't take over the songs per se.
The concept was, make the album your masterpiece, make it exactly what you would want it to be on stage, and then every show strive to recreate that, strive to recreate the perfection of the album.
Yeah, so we snagged a bunch of friends, like Tommy from the Oak Hill Drifters. He played pedal steel, right? And then Mr. Tonner played some organ and
some guitar.
And Matt played piano on it. So
and the viola.
And the viola.
Oh, and we have, what is that, a melodica on it?
That's right.
What is a melodica?
It's what John Baptiste plays in The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. A keyboard that you blow into.
It looks like an e-cigarette crossed with a guitar.
And you've played these songs, all of them live so far? Or are there some tracks that people haven't heard live?
There's one track on there that we have never played live yet. It was one that was written in response to the Pulse tragedy, and we haven't actually made that one out yet. But all the other ones we've been road testing for at least a couple of months now.
Are you going to play that track?
It's a little bit unclear. We haven't had too many extensive discussions about it, but I don't know, there's something about it being special to the album that kind of resonates as well. So I think it could go either way.
Yeah, it's a very emotional song. It brings up a lot of memories because it's still so fresh in our minds. But we wanted to pay tribute and to memorialize the feelings and the state of the city into a song that it will endure.
So what does the next couple of months hold? Are you going to tour around the state with the album? Are you doing some local shows? What do you guys got planned?
Bandmaster Tony, all right. Give them the lineup.
Here we go. So on October 20th, we're having our album release party at the Timaqua White House here in Orlando. It's at 2:30 in the afternoon, so
then, no babysitter required.
And then we're playing at Fiddler's Green on October 26th. It's kind of like a Halloween show. And then November 3rd and November 4th, we're going to be at the Lake Eola Bandshell as part of a fall festival for Cox Media. So
Fiesta in the Park?
Yeah, it's called Fiesta in the Park. Yeah. And that's exciting because we've never played that bandshell before.
Who are we opening for? I mean,
we're not opening. But okay, so as fate would have it, on November 3rd, right?
Yeah.
There's a guy named Brett Michaels. I'm not sure if you've heard of him. Like Poison. He'll be playing
on.
Is that what it is? Rock
of Love.
Anyway,
Rock
of Love
as well. Yeah.
He's going to be playing November 3rd.
And Lita Ford, too.
And Lita Ford. Mm-hmm. So they're having a pretty substantial showing out there, and
also BMO,
and we'll be playing from
what's the Venn diagram of Brett Michaels and BMO fans
Sean Quinn would be the
bandana
connection.
Wearing guess the we have bandanas in common.
He's an 80s shredder. Ozzy Osbourne to glam, from glam to Poison to Poison to Brett, and then the Brett to us. So,
And I believe Every Rose Has Its Thorn was an acoustic song. Am I right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
So there you go.
BMO, Justin Braun, Matt Giuliano, Dan Harshbarger, and Tony Mickle. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks, man.
BMO's new album is called Busting Out, and you can find a longer version of that interview, including Justin Braun talking about life as a mascot for a public television station and more, on our website, WMFE.org.
It was Seymour, the dancing television. Shout out to Elkhart, Indiana, WNIT Public Television.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Shania Richburg. Production assistance for this week's show from Emily Lang. You can find us online at wmfe.org/intersection. Download the podcast from iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening. Time around again and I